From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the historic split between the Sunni and Shia Muslims and how it explains the conflict in Iraq and the political alliances of Hezbollah. We talk with Vali Nasser. His new book is called The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. Nasser is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and also teaches Middle East and South Asia politics at the Naval Postgraduate School. And we talk about Hezbollah with Jeffrey Goldberg of The New Yorker magazine. He interviewed several leaders of the group in 2002. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hezbollah is an Islamist group of Shiite Muslims. It's aligned with Iran, which is a predominantly Shiite country. In Iraq, Sunni and Shiite Muslims are fighting each other. The historic split between Sunni and Shiite Muslims and how that's affected politics and war in the Middle East is the subject of the new book, The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. My guest is the author, Vali Nasser. He's a professor of Middle East and South Asia politics at the Naval Postgraduate School and an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Vali Nasser, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to begin by just asking you to make two columns for us. One of the most important countries and groups that are primarily Shia, and the other that are primarily Sunni.
Well, the Shiites are about 10 to 15% of the Muslim world, and the majority of them live in the Middle East. That means that most of the rest of the Muslim world is predominantly Sunni. So when we think of Malaysia, Indonesia, Senegal, Nigeria, there are no Shiites there. So let's focus on the Middle East where they coexist. The most important Shiite countries or Shia majority countries are Iran, Azerbaijan, Iraq, and Bahrain. And this does not mean that they actually rule in all these countries. And then Lebanon comes next with about somewhere between 45 to 50% of the population are Shiite. So they're the biggest community. And then everywhere else, they are minorities varying in size from about 20% of Afghanistan, Pakistan, to 30% of Kuwait, to 10 to 15% of Saudi Arabia.
And I want to ask you another just kind of framing question. In your book, you talk about the old Middle East compared to the new Middle East. What's the difference?
Well, even though if we looked at the demographics of this region in the area between Pakistan and Lebanon, there are almost as many Shiites as there are Sunnis. So there's a parity in terms of population. But outside of Iran, the Shiites have been shut out of power. So in countries in Iraq, even though they were a majority, the government under Saddam and even before him was ruled by a minority of Sunnis. In Bahrain, 75% of the population are Shiites, but it's ruled by a Sunni dynasty. And everywhere else where they're a minority, that is in Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf, they are excluded from a seat at the table of power and they don't have a share of resources, even though in Saudi Arabia, all the oil is in the Shia region. They get virtually none of the proceeds. And consequently, the old Middle East was really dominated by Sunnis. Even though the governments were secular Arab nationalists, it's the Sunni ruling classes, landed classes, the Sunni bureaucracy, militaries that dominated. And the Shiites largely lived as a minority. Whether they were majority or minority, they lived as a minority. After Iraq, this has changed. The Shias have assumed power in Iraq. Iraq is the very first Shia Arab country. And everywhere else, they are asking for greater powers, rights, and share of resources. And therefore, the new Middle East is likely to be more Shia in its character and far more defined by this struggle for power and resources between Shias and Sunnis than the old Middle East.
Let's look at what's happening now in the Middle East between Israel and Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a Shiite group. The Amal militia, which was the predecessor of Hezbollah, you say that the Amal militia became the beacon of the Shia awakening. In what way?
Well, Lebanon is actually the very first place in the Arab world where the Shiites broke away from a blind commitment to Arab nationalism and began to question whether or not it was benefiting them. And they began to demand their rights throughout the 1960s and particularly in the 1970s. They came under a lot of pressure from the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. They were paying with their lives and livelihoods for the conflict in South Lebanon. They began to assert a separate identity from the Palestinian and the Sunni Arab dominant identity in Lebanon. And Amal was the movement that essentially began this. And it began to organize the Shia youth and Shia power within a very distinctly sectarian Shia movement, which is Amal. And in, at some points, it was actually quite anti-Palestinian. When the Israelis invaded South Lebanon, in fact, the Shiites initially welcomed them with flowers and they greeted them well, which led many later on in, during the Iraq War to expect the same kind of reception for American troops as they pushed north from southern Iraq. Then Hezbollah was born essentially as a very distinctly Shia movement, one that followed Iran's ideological lead, but which was not as distinctly sectarian as Amal had been. Hezbollah has always tried to push for Shia power, but tried to do so within a context of unity with Sunnis around the cause of the Palestinians. You know, as being opposed to Israel, championing the Palestinians is a way for Hezbollah to couch Shia power behind a cause of unity.
I just want to get back to something that you said. You said that the Amal militia, which was the predecessor of Hezbollah, actually greeted the Israelis in 1982 when they came into Lebanon with flowers. I still find that so hard to, you know, in retrospect, so hard to imagine. Why did they take a more positive attitude towards Israelis' incursion into Lebanon in 1982?
Well, Amal as an organization did not do so. It was actually the Shia population of South Lebanon that did so.
Oh, I see.
Amal was very anti-Palestinian at one point. It actually put a siege on a number of Palestinian camps, including the famous Sabra and Shatila camps, and cut them off from water and food. This goes back to a conflict in South Lebanon when the Palestinians set up shop in South Lebanon and began to attack Israel throughout the 1970s. Israelis retaliated, destroying Shia villages, and there was an exodus of Shiites from South Lebanon into the poor suburbs of Beirut, which is now the Hezbollah stronghold. The Shiites gradually became quite bitter about the fact that the Palestinians would come in, take their land and forcibly recruit their youth and set up checkpoints in their towns in South Lebanon and then attack Israel and bring an Israeli retaliation with it. And they began to see the Palestinians essentially as usurpers, as people who came from the outside and imposed their will on the Shiites. So when the Israelis first came into Lebanon, the sort of gut reaction of the population there was to look at them as liberators. They were happy to see the PLO to be evicted from South Lebanon. And they took, and many say that in fact Israel's single biggest mistake in Lebanon was to overstay that initial welcome. Because exactly 100 days after the very first flowers were given to Israeli soldiers, the very first suicide bomber attacked an Israeli checkpoint.
When the Israeli army expelled the PLO from Lebanon, how did that affect the Shiite population in Lebanon and the development of Hezbollah?
Well, the Shiite population was happy for the PLO to go. And after all, the PLO, in a de facto way, was the militia of the Sunni population of Lebanon. So the expulsion of the PLO created a vacuum into which the Shia power could now grow. However, the Shiites also understood that the growth of their power to be successful, it could not be against the will of the broader Arab world. That for them to succeed, they have to champion the same Arab causes. And this was also the Iranian strategy at the time. So Iran helped create Hezbollah and helped nurture it as a force that would be simultaneously Shia, but also very anti-Israeli. And Hezbollah, unlike Amal, did not turn the sharp edge of its sword against the Palestinians, but rather against Israel. And ever since then, Hezbollah has been saying that it is the most successful military force against Israel in the Arab history. It has achieved what no Arab army has achieved, which is to force Israel to militarily retreat. And it is exactly the same kind of a goal that is driving Hezbollah today, to be able to do what Arab governments show themselves incapable of doing, which is to take Israel on.
Iran has backed Hezbollah, helped create Hezbollah. What does Iran want from Hezbollah?
Well, whenever you invest over a long period of time in an alliance, then it has its sort of own momentum. Iran has been associated with Hezbollah for over 20 years. There is a whole cadre of senior Iranian Revolutionary Guard commanders who at one point or another served in Lebanon in various capacities in the Bekaa Valley with units of the Revolutionary Guards that were working with Hezbollah. They know Lebanon well. They have friends in Hezbollah. There are intelligence connections. There are religious connections with the holy city of Qom in Iran. But also beyond that, Hezbollah represents Iran's only really successful case of establishing a beachhead for the Iranian revolution. Despite Khomeini's efforts to be recognized as a leader of the Muslim world after the Iranian revolution, Iran was never really able to get a foothold in the Arab world other than through Hezbollah in Lebanon. And then in more recent years, Iran has looked at Hezbollah essentially as an asset. The more Iran sees Israel as its main rival in the region and sees Israel as its main adversary, the more it's likely to look at Hezbollah as an asset in a broader regional power game with Israel.
If Hezbollah wants an Iranian-style revolution and wants an Islamic State, how do the other populations, the other religious populations within Lebanon, feel about that?
Well, this has been always an issue, and not only even with the rest of the populations, but also a good chunk of the Shia population of Lebanon, particularly the middle-class merchants and professionals, have also not been favorable to the religious ideology of Hezbollah and favor a far less doctrinaire and far less Iranian model of government. But I think over the years, Hezbollah has realized that the plurality of the population in Lebanon does not allow the implementation of an Iranian-style revolution. So despite the rhetoric, Hezbollah, after the Taif Agreement of 1990, agreed to participate in the existing political system in Lebanon, has been participating in elections. And in fact, in the last elections last year, it finally joined in a pan-Shiite alliance with Amal, which won about 4/5 of the Shia vote in Lebanon and a good chunk of also the Sunni and Palestinian vote as well. So it's become very pragmatic, and you have two wings to Hezbollah. One is the military wing, which does the attacks, the bombings, and the like. And then you have a political wing, which is engaged in the political process. And Hezbollah also runs a vast array of social services, orphanages, clinics, and the like in Shia neighborhoods. In some ways, Hezbollah has an IRA and a Sinn Féin side to it.
My guest is Vali Nasser. His new book is called The Shia Revival. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Vali Nasser, and he's the author of the book The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. Now, it's Hezbollah that controls militarily the southern border of Lebanon, which is just across the border from Israel. And it's from there that Hezbollah has been firing its rockets into Israel. How did Hezbollah get into the position where it controlled that part of Lebanon militarily?
Well, very early on, Hezbollah proved itself to be a very, very effective military force. And in particular, it made a very shrewd and effective use of what today we call suicide bombing, but in the 1980s we called martyrdom missions. And at that time, it was believed that only Shiites would do these things. But now we see that Hezbollah has served as a model for Sunnis as well, most recently in Iraq. And the ferocity of Hezbollah's campaign of suicide bombing against Israeli targets ultimately forced Israel to move out. And Hezbollah even was in the process capable of establishing at some points, casualty parity with Israel, which no other Arab military force has ever achieved. And Hezbollah was able to overshadow Amal, and given the combination of its success on the battlefield, which brings any force a great deal of popularity, you know, there's nothing as successful as success itself, and its ability to provide social services, schools, clinics, orphanages, and the like, made it a very dominant force, not only in South Beirut, but in South Lebanon. And then once Israeli forces left Lebanon, Hezbollah moved very rapidly into that territory and established military control over it through its military units, but also through its control of the villages and their economy and society as well.
Let's look at the current war between Israel and Hezbollah. Why do you think Hezbollah decided to take on Israel now and cross the border, kill several Israeli soldiers, and take hostage a couple of others?
Well, Hezbollah in the past 2 years has confronted a set of challenges that have diminished its popularity, if you would, on the Arab street beyond its core Shia support. First is when there was an assassination of the Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, and there was a call for withdrawal of Syria from Lebanon. Hezbollah took Syria's side, and this tarnished its nationalist image because it was seen to be supporting an occupying country. And secondly, the events in Iraq, when they happened, many outside of Hezbollah's core Shia supporters among Palestinians and Sunnis in the region, who lionized Hezbollah for its anti-American, anti-Israeli position, expected it to take the side of the insurgents in Iraq. In other words, support the anti-American forces in Iraq. But after all, Hezbollah is a Shia organization. Many Lebanese Shia follow Ayatollah Sistani. Many Lebanese Shiites look to what happened in Iraq as a good omen for also greater empowerment of Shiites in Lebanon. So Hezbollah's real deep loyalties lay with the Shiites in Iraq, which many Sunnis in the region have viewed as lackeys of Iran or as collaborators with the U.S. And this also sort of began to constrict Hezbollah. Hezbollah's hope was that by picking another fight with Israel and provoking Israel into a massive retaliation, and for Hezbollah to be seen as the champion of the Palestinian cause, that it can gain the high ground that it had before the events of the past 2-3 years.
But an interesting thing happened. The heads of several Arab governments criticized Hezbollah for taking on Israel. So how do you interpret that?
Well, first of all, I think Hezbollah and Iran are trying to force a paradigm shift on the region. Namely, Iranian president has been attacking Israel, has questioned Holocaust, has questioned Israel's right to exist, and Hezbollah is now sort of championing a military confrontation with Israel. All of these are, if you would, the pre-Oslo, pre-1980s paradigm for the region of a combative, confrontational approach to the Arab-Israeli issue. Now, most of the Arab states in the region have already subscribed to accepting Israel's right to exist and to a political solution to the problems in the region. So they don't look favorably upon Hezbollah's attempt to scuttle things on the ground and to shift things to into a different arena. One can also say that they see Iran's hand in this. And it worries them that the kind of Shia revival that they have been criticizing in Iraq is now finding a regional dimension, in the sense that it is the two Shia powers in the region that are now defining conflict and defining regional politics.
How do you, like, what do you see as the possible end game here in the war now between Israel and Hezbollah?
Well, every military conflict has its own dynamic, and it can very easily spiral in different directions regardless of what the original motivations were. I think Israel has an interest in making sure that Iran and Hezbollah don't come away from this conflict with the wrong impression that their policy of combativeness is going to yield results, and that Israel is not seen to be vulnerable to their strategy. On the other hand, I think Iran is interested in a limited conflict that would reveal the extent of its regional importance and power. And it's hoping that the U.S. and the West will understand that they have to engage Iran rather than confront Iran.
Vali Nasser is the author of the new book, The Shia Revival. He's a professor of Middle East and South Asia politics at the Naval Postgraduate School and is an adjunct senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of 10 Second Staircase, a Bryant and May British mystery by Christopher Fowler, author of The Water Room, and from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. Information at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk about Hezbollah with Jeffrey Goldberg, a correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. He interviewed several Hezbollah leaders a few years ago. And we continue our interview with Vali Nasser. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Vali Nasser, author of the new book, The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. Have you thought a lot, I imagine you have, about how Lebanon will be changed for years, perhaps decades, by the effects of the bombing?
Well, there are economic impacts. In other words, whatever Lebanon had gained in terms of becoming the banking, entertainment, cultural center of the region over the past decade obviously are being undone, and the infrastructure for economic boom is being affected. But I also think that this conflict would once again problematize Lebanon's political structure. The central issue that this conflict has brought to the fore is who is to define what is good for Lebanon. And I think in many ways, Hezbollah's argument is that they represent the majority or the largest community in that country, and that gives them the right to do so, even though the demographics of the Shiites in Lebanon is not reflected in the parliament, and Hezbollah has the Shiites have no more than 29 seats in the parliament. But I think the conflict is going to force far more a debate about when and how will Lebanese politics actually reflect the numbers in the country. And that debate may prove to be just as violent as the one that we saw, that we are witnessing in Iraq. In other words, the shift of power from the dominant communities towards the Shiites is a risky one and can be bloody.
In Iraq, the Sunni and Shiite Muslims have been fighting each other, and that fighting seems to, if anything, only be escalating. Saddam Hussein was a Sunni Muslim. We drove him out of power, and most of the other Sunnis we drove out of power too. Is a Shiite majority now in the Iraqi parliament. The Sunnis who we drove from power, Sunni leaders have now been asking the U.S. military to stay longer to help protect them from the Shiites. Your book is about the split between Shiite and Sunni Muslims throughout the Muslim world. How do you explain this shift, this split in Iraq?
Well, when the Iraqi regime first was changed, the Sunnis, who were the main losers of that change, also had greater military capability. In other words, foreign fighters, as well as leftovers of the Iraqi military and diehard supporters of Saddam, had the organization and military capability and also the willingness to attack the Americans and the Shiites. And they operated on the perception that if you got the United States out of Iraq very quickly, you could have a restoration of Sunnis back to power. And that they also operate under the belief that if you hit the Shiites hard enough, they would cower and essentially go back into their hole. The Shiites initially were not organized militarily well enough to respond, and they relied on the United States to deal with the insurgency. And Ayatollah Sistani also had a strategy of restraining the Shiites. After every bombing, after every attack, he would tell them to focus on the prize of winning Iraq through elections and not to bite into the apple of civil war, because that will disadvantage them. When the Samarra bombings happened, something broke among the Shiites. In other words, militant groups emerged who argued that Sistani's strategy of turn the other cheek is interpreted as weakness, and that the Shiites have to establish a balance of terror and they have to show force. And at the same time, the Shiites concluded the Americans cannot provide security to the Shiites. So as the Shiites began to show willingness to kill in equal numbers and to assassinate, engage in ethnic cleansing and the like, the balance of terror clearly changed the perception of the Sunnis. And given that they're a minority, ultimately in this game, a confrontation will favor the Shiites. So the Sunnis are now looking to the U.S., if you would, to help them balance out the Shiites.
Your book is about the division between Sunnis and Shiites within countries and between countries. How much of that split, and in Iraq, for instance, we're seeing intense fighting now between Sunnis and Shias, how much of that split is really about how the religion is practiced, and how much of it is really just about political power?
Well, this is much like the Protestant-Catholic split. At times it is about doctrine, particularly older times in history, but at times it's about identity, just like Northern Ireland today. It's not about what you practice, it's about who you are. But what we're seeing in the current period is that we have a particularly intense period of rivalry between Shiites and Sunnis. This is really because changes in the region, which has started with Iraq, is recalibrating the distribution of power between Shias and Sunnis. In many ways, it is about politics and is about distribution of power and distribution of wealth.
So do you think that the new Shia majority government in Iraq is changing the balance of power in the Middle East? Do you see a connection between that and the war between Israel and Hezbollah?
Well, yes, in some ways, mainly because symbolically, Iraq is the very first Shia Arab country. One has not existed before, where the Shiites have actually ruled over an Arab country. And the fact that change is possible has given hope and expectation to Arabs, to Shias elsewhere. The fact that political change and elections in Iraq has created an expectation of change in Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia, in Lebanon, in Pakistan, and elsewhere as well. And on the other side, it has created enormous amount of anxiety among the Sunnis and a certain resistance now to voting, to political reform, and to change. And also, Iraq has another dynamic for this region, namely, because the Shia-Sunni conflict there is particularly violent and bloody, it is producing very, very violent ideologies, which we most notably saw in Abu Musab Zarqawi, that will ultimately travel elsewhere in the region and will be a threat.
Yeah, he was the head of Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia.
Exactly. And the kind of, you know, virulent ideology that is festering among the insurgents in Iraq will ultimately go back to Jordan, will go back to Egypt, will go back to Saudi Arabia, the same way as in which the ideology of bin Laden in Afghanistan ended up going back to the countries from which his fighters came.
Now, I know that you grew up in Iran. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
And so I assume that you are Shiite Muslim.
Yes.
Did you grow up with a sense of the split between Sunni and Shiite?
No, I actually discovered I was a Shiite when I first went to Pakistan on a research trip, because the Shiites were about 20 to 25% of the minority of the population in Pakistan, were engaged, if you would, in a sectarian conflict at the time with militant Sunni groups. And it was very clear that even though hostility was not everywhere, nevertheless, consciousness of identity of who is a Shia and who is a Sunni was very strong. And it was as an Iranian, I did not confront the Shia-Sunni issue until I went somewhere where the division of the population made it an issue.
And did you feel very much in the minority in Pakistan? Did you feel like you were in a discriminated against minority?
Well, it was not necessarily discrimination so much. It was as being typecast as the other. Particularly Pakistanis are very conscious religiously, and they, at least the more religious segments, tend to look at the Shiites as non-Muslims, as un-Islamic. And it was eye-opening for me at that time to be, you know, respectfully put in the category of an outsider. And it is, I guess, in some ways, it's like the history of Judaism in Europe. It's the Gentiles often who confirmed Jewish identity and underscored it. In many parts of the Muslim world, it is the attitude of the Sunnis towards Shiites that has hardened their identity.
Do Sunnis and Shias have any difference in opinion about martyrdom and suicide bombers?
Well, yes. I mean, the doctrine of martyrdom was strongest among Shiites, because the third Shiite imam, which is most popular with Shiites, who is buried in the city of Karbala in Iraq, was martyred in the 7th century, and his martyrdom was really the birth of Shiism, in the same way as the crucifixion of Christ was the birth of Christianity. And as a result, the Shiites have always looked favorably upon martyring oneself in the cause of truth, emulating that early day saint. The Sunnis never really had a doctrine of martyrdom. And in fact, I remember only 10 years ago, people would say that Sunnis will never do the kinds of things Shiites are willing to do, the kind of suicide bombings, because they don't have a doctrine of martyrdom. But we learn that actually these doctrines can travel. Namely, just when the Shiites stopped engaging in martyrdom practices, radical Sunni groups began to pick it up, and now it's a staple of their mode of operation rather than that of the Shiites.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Vali Nasser is the author of the new book, The Shia Revival. Coming up, we talk about Hezbollah with Jeffrey Goldberg of The New Yorker magazine. This is Fresh Air. We invited Jeffrey Goldberg to talk with us about Hezbollah. His two-part article about Hezbollah in the New Yorker magazine in 2002 won the National Magazine Award for Reporting and the Center for Public Integrity's Award for Outstanding International Investigative Reporting. Goldberg has covered the Middle East for the New Yorker magazine and is now a Washington correspondent. His memoir, Prisoners, A Muslim and Jew Across the Middle East Divide, will be published this fall. It's about the time in the 90s when he briefly moved to Israel and served in the Israeli army. I talk with him about meeting leaders of Hezbollah for his New Yorker article. You met with some leaders of Hezbollah in 2002.
Right.
How did you manage to do that?
I called them up on the telephone in Beirut. Hezbollah actually does have a spokesman's office, and I expressed an interest in meeting its leaders and getting a tour of its facilities in the southern suburbs of Beirut, where a lot of this bombing is now taking place, as well as in the Bekaa Valley and in South Lebanon, which Israel had recently, at that point, evacuated. And they were amenable. Every terrorist group has a story to tell, and it wants its story out.
And so it was that easy? You just called the head publicist for Hezbollah?
Yeah, they're a little suspicious, as you might well imagine, particularly with someone with my last name. But I make no bones about who I am. And that sort of straightforwardness usually works in my favor. They actually, I know for a fact that they Googled me. The vaunted Hezbollah intelligence service used Google just like everyone else. I mean, the thing that you have to remember about any of these groups is that while we might look at them and think terrorists, they, of course, define themselves as resistance fighters, freedom fighters, and they have a narrative as well. And they want that narrative out.
And what was the narrative that they presented to you?
Their narrative is very complex. Their super narrative, if you will, their Islamic narrative, is that they are the party, even more than Hamas or Palestine Islamic Jihad, certainly more than the secular Palestinian organizations, PLO, organizations surrounding the PLO. They are at the vanguard of anti-Zionist, anti-Israel resistance, and that they are the stalwart fighters who will bring down the state of Israel and the whole Zionist entity, as they call it, which is, in secular Palestinian terms, is an archaic term. It's the PLO stopped using that in the 70s, but Hezbollah still uses it today. So that's part of their narrative. Their narrative is that they are the best fighters, that they are the ones who will bring about the defeat of Israel on behalf of the Palestinians. This, by the way, has caused a lot of jealousy between Hamas and Hezbollah. Though they work together on occasion, they're also quite competitive with each other. Each one wants to be the symbol across the Muslim world, across the Arab world, of anti-Israel steadfastness. So that's part of their narrative. Their other narrative, of course, is that they are a Lebanese political party and that they are trying to play politics within the system, and that they are the representatives of the dispossessed Shiite plurality or majority at this point, we don't know, since there's no census recently, of the dispossessed Shiites of Lebanon. There's another part of their narrative, which is that they are the embodiment of the spirit and the will and the beliefs of Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder, the leader of the Iranian Islamic Revolution, 1979. So they have multiple personalities, this organization.
Who did you meet with in 2002 from Hezbollah?
I saw a whole bunch of people, including the spiritual leader, Sheikh Fadlallah. I met Sheikh Nasrallah only for a minute. There was a long argument in Hezbollah in these circles. I was there for a few weeks, whether or not they should let me see him. And I met him in a group of people. But as soon as I started asking questions, they shuffled him away. I met a lot of the fighters and leaders of the fighters in South Lebanon and in the Bekaa Valley as well. The guy, I guess, who gave me the best understanding of the worldview is the spiritual leader of the so-called spiritual leader of Hezbollah, Sheikh Fadlallah, who is a Iranian-trained cleric who has extraordinary influence among the Shiites of Lebanon.
Now, you're Jewish. How did he react to being interviewed by a Jewish journalist?
Whenever I deal with Islamic terrorists, Islamists, clerics, and extremists, it doesn't matter where, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Lebanon, the same rules generally tend to hold, which is that there's an attraction-repulsion phenomenon that takes place. In other words, they're repulsed by Jews, repulsed by everything that they think Jews and Judaism and Israel and Zionism stand for. On the other hand, they spend most of their lives thinking about Jews, so when one actually shows up in their living room, it's quite an event. And what they want to do, generally, this is in my experience, is get into a big argument. They want to ask questions, and they want to argue points. Some of the points they want to argue are things that I'm not ready to argue about. I mean, they want to argue about. I remember with Sheikh Fadlallah, I think he had a, I guess what I would call a profound misunderstanding of what the Talmud is and what the Torah is. And I wasn't going to go there. I'm not going to start trying to disabuse him of his fantastical beliefs and what is contained, what secrets are contained in the Torah. And I've seen this a number of times, even with Hezbollah in the South, I remember in South Lebanon, when they realize that I'm Jewish and it's not something I hide, when they realize I'm Jewish, sometimes they'll even call up friends and say, hey, come over, there's a Jewish guy here, you're not going to believe it. And you know, I find that arguing with them brings out more information that I can use in my articles.
My guest is Jeffrey Goldberg of The New Yorker magazine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeffrey Goldberg, former Middle East correspondent and current Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. He won a National Magazine Award for his 2002 New Yorker article about Hezbollah. Where was the headquarters of Hezbollah that you visited, and what did they look like?
It's actually very interesting. There was a bifurcation, if you will. Most of the Hezbollah buildings are in the Dahiya, the so-called southern suburbs of Beirut. You see that in the newspaper, the southern suburbs. They're not very suburban looking by our standards of suburban. They're big, tall buildings and crowded streets. And what I noticed was very interesting, and this is what one of the Hezbollah fellows told me, was that the offices were fairly makeshift. One of the people I was dealing with there told me that they're built and stocked and manned in such a way that they can be broken down in a half hour or an hour. That there's not a great deal of investment put into the aesthetics of these headquarters buildings, not for lack of money, by the way, but because there is the expectation, now fulfilled, I guess, that Israel would target these buildings first if it ever came to open conflict. The building that always struck me as quite different was the headquarters of the Hezbollah television station, Al Manar, which when you walk into the lobby, it looks, it's nicer than the NPR lobby in Washington, as a matter of fact. It's a marble and glass building and air-conditioned and carpeted, and the studios are top-notch, and the editing suites are top-notch. And I was always struck by the amount of money that they poured into their television station. But generally speaking, it's an organization that didn't invest quite a lot of money in its above-ground facilities. Now, of course, as you probably know, Hezbollah has a series of bunkers that they built underneath this neighborhood, connected by tunnels and buried fairly deeply in the ground. I was not allowed to see those, obviously, but I assume that they are well-provisioned and built to last.
You mentioned how nice the lobby of Al Manar, the Hezbollah TV station, was. I assume that's the same location that was bombed.
It was. I think Israel understands the central role Al Manar plays in propagating the true faith of Hezbollah. On the other hand, it's not directly a military target.
As somebody who lived in Israel, lived on a kibbutz, joined the Israeli army in the early 90s, do you think that Israel's use of force now is disproportionate? Are you worried about the number of Lebanese civilians who are being hurt, about the destruction of some of the Lebanese infrastructure?
This is the most difficult question of all. I don't know. It's very interesting, and this is an argument that people have been having forever and will continue to have. Hezbollah bases itself in heavily crowded civilian areas of Beirut. It hides its weapons in mosques and underneath hospitals and in villages. It fires its rockets from the centers of villages filled with civilians in order to protect itself, in order to limit the damage that Israel can cause to it. So then you have to ask yourself, you're an Israeli prime minister, you're elected by the people to defend Israel. Someone is firing a rocket into Haifa, killing civilians, and they're firing this rocket from a heavily populated area. What do you do? I think, by the way, that if you look at what's happened over the past week, I think some of the things that haven't happened are more interesting than the things that have happened. I actually think that both sides have not crossed all of the red lines yet. I hope they don't cross all of the red lines. But I think Israel has the capability of flattening all of Lebanon in about 12 hours. And it's been fairly pinpoint in its attacks. Hezbollah hasn't yet fired its most deadly rockets or most of its most deadly rockets, and they haven't yet hit Tel Aviv. I think that they understand that if they cross yet another red line, that Israel will simply flatten all of the Shiite areas of Beirut and flatten most of South Lebanon. One wishes that not a single civilian would be hurt. But one of the things I noticed about Hezbollah, and going back to this question about the offices, is that many of the Hezbollah offices in South Beirut, in the southern suburbs of Beirut, were placed on the lower floors of civilian apartment buildings. And by my Western standards of morality, that's quite immoral. You shouldn't, I mean, literally, the fearsome and brave leaders of this so-called resistance movement were hiding behind women and children. And you have to ask yourself, and you have to put yourself in the shoes of the Israeli prime minister, who is supposed to defend his people, and ask yourself, because Hezbollah has made this choice, does this mean that I cannot go and attack the people who are attacking my people? It's a terrible dilemma. It's tragic and it's terrible. But I would look a little bit more to Hezbollah's culpability in this, and a little less to Israel's culpability. In Gaza, I think that some of the actions of the last couple of weeks were probably an overreaction. But in Lebanon, it's hard for me to say that quite yet.
Well, Jeffrey Goldberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Goldberg writes for The New Yorker magazine. His memoir, Prisoners, A Muslim and a Jew Across the Middle East Divide, will be published this fall. Tomorrow we'll talk about Lebanon with Julia Chuker of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She's Lebanese and has lived in the U.S. for the past 6 years. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the bombing of Lebanon and the progress Lebanon had been making toward democracy with Julia Chuker, a Lebanese scholar who has lived in the U.S. for 6 years. She's with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.